The Bible never explicitly informs us that on Sukkot we are obligated to take a citron. Rather, the phrase utilized in Leviticus is pre-Eitz Hadar, the beautiful fruit of a tree or the fruit of a beautiful tree. It is only through rabbinic tradition that we identify this fruit as an etrog. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 52, the citron stoning incident. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. It is an annual image of Sukkot, one at the heart of the celebrated Israeli film Ushpizin. The selection of a perfect, unblemished etrog, or citron, to hold in one's hands with the palm frond when celebrating the harvest festival of Sukkot. But in one episode in Jewish history, the citron was utilized not only in celebration of a biblical festival, but also in rebellion against a king, in a story that illustrates how far the Hasmonean house would fall. In 144 BCE, John Hyrcanus, or Yochanan Hyrcanus, is succeeded by his eldest son, Aristobulus, who reigns for 1 year. He is the first of the Hasmoneans to call himself king of Jerusalem and Judea rather than merely prince or ethnarch. In this short reign, Aristobulus managed to starve his mother to death for opposing his power, to imprison several other brothers, and to engineer the murder of his brother Antigonus, whom he once loved. What Josephus describes about this king sounds Shakespearean, a combination of Macbeth seeing the ghost of Banquo and Lady Macbeth's moaning, "Out, out, damn spot." Quote, "This Aristobulus loved his next brother Antigonus and treated him as his equal, but the others he held in bonds. He also cast his mother into prison because she disputed the government with him, for Hyrcanus had left her to be mistress of all. He also proceeded to that degree of barbarity as to kill her in prison with hunger." End quote. This is Aristobulus, a monarch who murders his mother by starving her to death and imprisons several of his brothers. What of Antigonus, the sibling he loved? Josephus describes how, when King Aristobulus falls ill, Antigonus gathers a group to pray for the monarch, while evil members of the court convince the king that this gathering indicates that Antigonus himself seeks to reign. As we quote from Josephus, note that this terrible tale takes place on Sukkot, Tabernacles. But when Antigonus was once returned from the army, and that feast was then at hand when they make tabernacles to the honor of God, it happened that Aristobulus was fallen sick, and that Antigonus went up, most splendidly adorned and with his soldiers about him in their armor, to the temple, to celebrate the feast and to put up many prayers for the recovery of his brother. When some wicked persons, who had a great mind to raise a difference between the brethren, made use of this opportunity of the pompous appearance of Antigonus and of the great actions which he had done, and went to the king and spitefully aggravated the pompous show of his at the feast, and pretended that all these circumstances were not like those of a private person, that these actions were indications of an affectation of royal authority. End quote. Convinced by these ruthless courtiers that his brother Antigonus seeks the throne, King Aristobulus has him killed. But then the king is so torn by grief that he goes mad, and when his own blood mixes with that of his deceased brother, the monarch erupts. Quote, "But Aristobulus repented immediately of this slaughter of his brother, on which account his disease increased upon him, and he was disturbed in his mind upon the guilt of such wickedness, insomuch that his entrails were corrupted by his intolerable pain, and he vomited blood. At which time one of the servants that attended upon him, and was carrying his blood away, did by divine providence, as I cannot but suppose, slip down and shed part of his blood at the very place where there were spots of Antigonus's blood, there slain, still remaining. And when there was a cry made by the spectators, as if the servant had on purpose shed the blood in that place, Aristobulus heard it and inquired what the matter was, and as they did not answer him, he was the more earnest to know what it was, it being natural to men to suspect that what is thus concealed is very bad. So upon his threatening and forcing them by terrors to speak, they at last told him the truth. Whereupon he shed many tears in that disorder of mind which arose from his consciousness of what he had done, and gave a deep groan and said, 'I am not therefore, I perceive, to be concealed from God in the impious and horrid crimes I have been guilty of, but a sudden punishment is coming upon me for the shedding of the blood of my relations. And now, O thou most impudent body of mine, how long wilt thou retain a soul that ought to die in order to appease the ghosts of my brother and my mother? Why dost thou not give it all up at once? And why do I deliver up my blood drop by drop to those whom I have so wickedly murdered?' In saying which last words, he died." having reigned a year, end quote. It is at this point in 143 BCE, with King Aristobulus dead, his mother starved to death, his beloved brother Antigonus murdered, that his wife, known as Salome Alexandra or Shlom Tzion, steps forward. We know next to nothing about the queen's life story up to this point. The Babylonian Talmud describes her as the sister of the leader of Pharisaic Judaism, one of the heroes of rabbinic literature, Shimon ben Shetach, and we will, in another lecture, offer an account of who he was. What is clear from all accounts is that, in contrast to the monarchy into which Shlom Tzion married, her loyalty to the Pharisees is famous, public, and unwavering. Lacking children from King Aristobulus, she now chooses to engage in levirate marriage to one of her previously imprisoned brothers-in-law, selecting Alexander Yanaeus, or Alexander Yanai, thereby allowing him to become both king and high priest in the place of Aristobulus. Alexander Yanai rules and ministers in a Jerusalem that is a religious tinderbox on the brink of explosion. The priests, many of them Sadducees, operate within the temple, but the people who pray there are loyal to Pharisaic religious tradition. Therefore, what took place during festivals in Jerusalem was inevitably a source of great sensitivity and controversy. Conflict within the sacred space was inevitable. And when you add a high priest who is himself a king, who, following his father, now sides with the elite Sadducees against the populace and against the Pharisaic leadership that has the population's love, one is left with a recipe for disaster. Every holiday in Jerusalem features potential for disagreement, but it is on one Sukkot that everything erupts. This sacred time is one of the rare occasions where the entire population of Jerusalem is allowed into the courtyard of the temple, holding aloft their palm fronds and citrons as the priests perform what is known as Nisuch HaMayim, the pouring of a water libation upon the altar. The Sadducees reject this water pouring ritual because it has no explicit source in the written Torah and is derived from Pharisaic tradition. Thus, the Mishnah recounts how one of the priests in one episode poured the water on his own feet instead of on the altar, and the population surrounding the altar reacted in a great rage. From Josephus' parallel account of the story, we are informed that this priest was none other than King Alexander Yanai himself. Quote, "For at a festival which was then celebrated, when he stood upon the altar was going to sacrifice, the nation rose up against him and pelted him with citrons, which they then had in their hands, because the laws of the Jews required that at the Feast of Tabernacles," end quote. The scene is almost impossible to imagine. The monarch is stoned by the population, who, as one, launch their religious fruit in his face. What follows from the enraged monarch is absolutely awful. Upon experiencing this citron stoning, Josephus writes, Yanai, quote, "flew into a rage and killed about 6,000 of them. He also built a partition wall of wood around the altar and the temple. Beyond that partition, it was lawful only for the priest to enter, and by this means, he obstructed the people from coming to him," end quote. Consider what has occurred. The Jewish participation in the Sukkot celebration inside the temple around the altar is every year the summit of Simcha, the ultimate embodiment of Jewish joy. And now, suddenly the king, allied with the elitist priests, prevents the masses, the Jewish people, from entering that sacred space. In the days that follow, civil war engulfs Judea with tens of thousands dead. In a series of battles of the masses loyal to the Pharisees against Yanai, the king ultimately emerges victorious, and he punishes his enemies in what is perhaps the most vile act committed by a Jewish king against his fellow Jews. This is the description communicated by Josephus. Yanai, quote, "did one of the most barbarous actions in the world to them. For as he was feasting with his concubines in the sight of all the city, he ordered about 800 of them to be crucified. And while they were still alive, he ordered the throats of their children and wives to be cut before their eyes," end quote. As we ponder this barbarism, ladies and gentlemen, we note a profound, terrible irony. This king is a direct descendant of the heroic Hasmoneans who had once purified Jerusalem from the abominations of the pagans. And now this king pollutes that very same site by shedding the blood of traditional Jews. Why did the masses loyal to the Pharisees throw their etrogs, their citrons, at the monarch? Was it merely an act of protest? Perhaps. But there is also possibly poetry, profound symbolism to this act. The Bible never explicitly informs us that on Sukkot we are obligated to take a citron. Rather, the phrase utilized in Leviticus is pre-Eitz Hadar, the beautiful fruit of a tree, or the fruit of a beautiful tree. It is only through rabbinic tradition that we identify this fruit as an etrog. The etrog, in other words, as Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik noted in his analysis of this story, is the ultimate symbol of the oral law. It is, as it were, an emblem of the religious love and loyalty of the masses for the Pharisaic tradition, their rejection of the autocratic elite and its worldview. To this, one might add the following. It is initially unclear why the etrog qualifies as the fruit of a beautiful tree. As Gil Mark's Encyclopedia of Jewish Food tells us, quote, historically, the citron, to put it mildly, was not a very useful plant. It was not the most hardy tree. Its wood was not prized as lumber. It was not one of the tallest trees, vulnerable to cold temperatures, nor were its fruits considered a luxury food in the ancient world, like cherries or kumquats, end quote. If one Googles a citron tree, one will not find it to be the most beautiful botanical specimen. Even if Peter, Paul, and Mary famously sang, lemon tree very pretty, and the lemon flower sweet. So what, for Pharisaic tradition, makes the etrog tree so hadar, so glorious, such a botanical treasure? The answer, as I argued in my Sacred Time series, lies in the following fascinating fact, also noted by Gil Marx, quote, the citron is unique in that it is the only tree that can flower and bear fruit throughout the year under proper conditions. It can also distinctively retain the fruit from one year to the next. Thus, the citron is the only tree that can have buds, blossoms, and mature fruit at the same time, end quote. The citron tree, in other words, embodies for Jewish tradition what is the most beautiful, the most glorious, the most profoundly Jewish value of all, continuity, the bond between generations. The etrog's identity, then, itself embodies the oral law, the virtue of transmission that lies at the heart of Pharisaic rabbinic life. Thus, this etrog-throwing movement, launched in defiance of the Sadducee king's rejection of the water libation and in protest of the monarch siding with the Sadducees, has many theological layers to it. My grandfather, Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, once reflected that if on Sukkot, the holiday described as the most joyous of the Jewish year, we are instructed by tradition to pour not only wine but water on the altar, water which is so simple but so essential, it is to emphasize that it is not the luxuries of life like wine that are most important, but rather life itself that we see as a gift and in which we so profoundly rejoice. We can now understand the poetry of this populist rebellion against the king. Yanai, having joined the elite, rejected the celebration of simple water. And in response, the people, the populace that he rejected, threw at him the citron, symbol of Pharisaic tradition and continuity. Several generations before, the Maccabees had celebrated a second Sukkot in a purified temple. Now, Sukkot marked the undoing of both Aristobulus and Yanai and the loss of worthiness for the Hasmonean house to rule. But soon, one not born to the Maccabees will come to the throne, and she will be one of the greatest Jewish leaders that ever lived. This is Meir Soloveitchik. Looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.